Just a note on accessibility. From now on, we are uploading music-free versions of each episode. You can find those at our blog, jetpack.zoob.net or jetpack.zoob.net. The blog post for each episode features an embedded player with a music-free version. And you can also find transcripts of a number of our episodes pinned to the top of the blog. Before we start, this podcast is sponsored by your personal favourite movie franchise. With the old characters you loved as an impressionable child, and the new characters you hate as a sad, horny adult, your personal favourite movie franchise defines you as a person. We don't need your love, we need your attention. So whatever your hot take, just keep watching and keep talking about it. Your personal favourite movie franchise is owned by Vertical Corp. You can find more information at tinyurl.com/verticalcorp.
What was that URL again?
tinyurl.com/verticalcorp.
And remember to keep talking about your favorite franchises on the Twitter machine. As a consumer with no declared pecuniary interest, I'll have to pay them a visit.
You will pay them a visit. tinyurl.com/verticalcorp.
I got that.
tinyurl.com/verticalcorp.
And money, you see the shining sea, and we're all the crime-free cities, rockets on our backs, and we're on the smooth-moving sidewalks, and where's my jet?
Welcome, listeners, to Where's My Jetpack, a politics and pop culture podcast with sci-fi and socialist leanings. We broadcast from Dyer Station, Antarctica, on the last Saturday of every month. I'm Ani White, and this is my equatorially hot co-host, Derek Johnson.
Yep. Thank you, Ani.
This month, we're looking at the question of authorial intent and audience interpretation under the headline of The Author is Undead. Then to wrap up, we're bringing on kaiju superfan Jace Short, who we've had on before, to chat about the new Godzilla vs. Kong, which I just saw recently at the Dyer Station IMAX.
How does an Antarctic base have an IMAX?
Oh, Vertical Corp funded it on the condition we only show properties they own. Then they pulled funding, but the cinema's still there. It was basically empty, but it's still there. Before we get on to all that, some recs, Derek.
I would recommend that past episode with Jace Short. That was a really good one. I was not able to completely take part in, and I would recommend their book or their contribution to that book on kaiju fiction. And I anxiously await Kong versus Godzilla. For pop culture and political analysis, I would recommend the reviews of the Snyder Cut of the Justice League by Jesse Gender and Maggie Mae Fish, as well as the Red Letter Media one, and post-9/11 action movies by Renegade Cut.
And without spoiling anything, I will say Godzilla vs. Kong was great fun. Snyder Cut was boring. It was deeply, deeply boring, in my opinion. But my first rec is from the podcast Bad Gaze, which looks at problematic gaze of history. Another one that's worth looking at is the one on Roy Cohn, terrible Republican who helped people like Trump along and was involved in some of the worst of McCarthyism. But specifically recommending the episode on Smith singer and solo artist Morris, which nailed it in my view. And this is very relevant to the question of author and audience, which we're talking about this month. And personally, the Smiths helped me survive an angsty gay teenagerhood. So Morrissey's trajectory towards the far right has been really grim to see. As undead authors go, Morrissey strikes me as a particularly grotesque example, weighing like a nightmare on the brains of the living. The Bad Gays podcast goes into this in some depth, looking at both his work and his life from the 80s through to today, and pulling no punches on the problems with his politics. Next, Rick, if you've been living under a rock culturally speaking, is the video for hip-hop track Montero by Lil Nas X. I already recommended his video for Holiday, best Christmas movie since Die Hard, but Montero takes it to a whole new level, so Holliday's inclusion of the line, "I may bottom on the low, but I top shit," seemed edgy, but now he escalates to a fully fledged biblical gay epic. And when I say gay, he gives the devil a lap dance. It's not subtle or subtext, and it's really landed culturally. It's not subtext, it's dom text. And in the very likely event you already know about Montero, unless you're a real billboard avoider, I'm going to rep some slightly older queer hip-hop. So there was a kind of a surge of this a few years ago, and Lil Nas X has helped bring it into the mainstream, or again, the Billboard charts. So my recs are Kate's the Killer, an artist fully willing to openly rap about sodomy. Listen to something like Goody Goody's. He's just, yeah, very direct and ruthless with it. Makes Lil Nas X look like child's play. The Zebra Cats and the Gina Red Fox track I'm a Reed, which does something perversely brilliant with ball culture language. And also Mickey Blanco, who has an almost industrial sound, which personally works for me. I'm a big fan of that kind of industrial style of production. And as usual, I'll link to these artists on the blog. Derek?
I would like to recommend the Tied Together But Separate videos criticizing J.K. Rowling on this subject by Lindsay Ellis and ContraPoints.
And also in the YouTube pop culture commentary sphere, we've previously wrecked Jim Sterling on here, but I thought that was worth an update. So Jim Sterling, the leftist gaming commentator come entertainer, come comedian, come amateur wrestler, recently came out as gender trash, in their words, something I strongly identify with. They prefer they, them pronouns, still go by the name Jim, but the full name James Stephanie Sterling. Watching their Jimquisition videos weekly, it's been lovely to see them come out and transition in real time, and their new, more femmy costumes are just as fabulous as the older, arguably mask, though still certainly very camp, costumes. I'd been aiming to set up a Patreon contribution to their project for a while, and the coming out video is what prompted me to finally get around to it. So yeah, definitely check out Jim Stephanie Sterling on YouTube. Thank God for them. And as always, we'll link these recs at the blog, jetpack.zoob.net. For your meat space recs, get vaccinated if you can. Try to pay small artists, but remember it's okay to rip off big corporations. And remember it's okay to not be economically productive every waking hour. Also, don't take advice from impoverished podcasters. This month we're talking about the death of the author, or undeath of the author. First, I'd like to say what this discussion is not about. So, death of the author is not about separating the art from the artist, as it's commonly used, which is an ethical position that it's okay to enjoy art from problematic artists. That's not what death of the author means. It's not even really what the death of the author is about. So, death of the author is a position on artistic interpretation. It's associated with French literary theorist Roland Barthes. And basically, the argument is that meaning is made by audiences and should not be constrained by authorial intent. So, while separating the art from the artist is a denial of ethical responsibility on the part of audiences, death of the author is more of a call to actively interpret work in new ways. It's not to say we should necessarily forgive problematic artists. It's more to say that audiences interpret in all sorts of ways, and that that's part of how meaning is created.
What about killing the author?
Well, Roland Barthes certainly attempts to kill the author, and I'm going to argue that even after Roland Barthes killed the author remained undead. That said, just a brief comment on that ethical question of separating the art from the artist, which again is not our main topic. Everything is problematic, but this doesn't absolve audiences of any ethical responsibility. So if an artist crosses an ethical line, such as open fascism, it is worth financially boycotting them, particularly particularly during their lifetime when they can use that money to promote their politics. So to be blunt, fuck J.K. Rowling, fuck Morrissey, don't give them any money, whatever their work may have meant to you at a certain point in your life. But this is a separate question from what art means to audiences, and that's what Death of the Author is about. It's about audience interpretation. And another caveat, what this isn't about. Art and entertainment aren't just about meaning or messages. They're not all didactic. There's also experiential. So watching Terminator 2, I'm enjoying the explosions and stunts. Watching Jurassic Park, I'm admiring how cool and scary velociraptors are. Watching a Wong Kar-wai Christopher Doyle flick, beautiful cinematography. But art also involves the production of meaning. Stories help us understand our lives. And my analysis here is focused on that, on the way meaning is produced. And more specifically, we're discussing whether the meaning of art is produced by authors, audiences, or both. So, famous position holds that the author is dead, that only audience interpretation matters. To quote original theorist Roland Barthes, the birth of the reader must be ransomed by the death of the author. My argument here is that the author is undead, a halfway position meaning that independent audience interpretation matters, but the author is still around. They live on after death, informing our interpretation. But if the author is undead, are the audience also a horde of zombies infected by them? Do we crave brains?
Brains.
Precisely. Or do our own brains suffice? So to keep stretching this metaphor, a decent example here is George A. Romero's classic zombie movie Night of the Living Dead, released in 1968. And in my view, that's the greatest horror movie, at least of the 60s. And it is also the movie that really created the modern zombie. We reviewed it a couple of years ago now. Night, for those who don't know, is mostly set in a fortified house surrounded by zombies. And the drama largely centers on the clash between the living about how to survive the situation. And the African-American hero Ben, played by Dwayne Jones, clashes throughout with old white man Harry Cooper, played by Carl Hardman. And he's also a very sweaty old white man. So it's all about a smart, resourceful young black hero clashing with a sweaty, paranoid old white man who's probably going to get everyone killed. And Romero insists that Dwayne Jones simply gave the best audition, that the movie wasn't intended as a commentary on race. But this is a movie made in the late period of the Civil Rights Movement, the year when President Johnson signed the Voting Rights Act and the Fair Housing Act, and the year when Martin Luther King was assassinated. Even now, it's hard to watch the closing scene in which a mob of armed white men shoot the black hero, admittedly mistaking him for a zombie, and not think of lynchings.
Or did they?
Well, yes, exactly. Did they mistake him for a zombie? Exactly. So it's hard to believe that, again, in the year of MLK's death, the filmmakers weren't thinking about race. But to an extent, it also doesn't matter, because the cultural impact of the movie transcends the personal feelings of the filmmaker. So whether Romero intended the subtext or not, the political resonances are there, and that's really what Death of the Author is about. And the rest of the Dead series would lean into the apparent political subtext, with Dawn of the Dead portraying mindless zombies wandering around a shopping mall consuming, Day of the Dead depicting a clash between scientific and military methods, and Land of the Dead straight up depicting a zombie revolution. And if you don't believe me about the revolution, watch Land of the Dead. Although, who knows, you may come away with something completely different. The issue isn't just the separation of the author from the audience, but also the many diverging ways that audiences interpret.
Hey, something just hit me, Ani.
Go on.
We didn't actually review those movies. It was actually our outs on a separate timeline a year in the future from that period.
It was Derek and Ani's Z1 in 2020, you're right. We did originally broadcast it in timeline Z3 2019, to be fair. It had just been sent back to us from our outs. Good point.
Oh, my nose is bleeding.
Yes. Okay, so it was recorded about a year ago in a different timeline and broadcast about a year before in another timeline. To quote the original text, The Death of the Author, written by French literary theorist Roland Barthes in 1967, in his story Sarrasine, Balzac. Is it Balzac or Balzac? I don't know. It's going to become increasingly inappropriate. Speaking of the castrato disguised as a woman. See, you would think I picked this paragraph because it was like my personal fixation, but it's the opening paragraph of the essay. This is how the essay starts. So
it seems to be very similar to that Ballbusters timeline as well.
Yes, well, as I say, this is how the essay starts. This is not just my personal fixations coming out. So Balzac, speaking of the castrato disguised as a woman, writes this sentence, quote, within the story, "It was woman with her sudden fears, her irrational whims, her instinctive fears, her unprovoked bravado, her daring and her delicious delicacy of feeling," close quote. And then Barthes continues, "So who is speaking in this way? Is it the story's hero concerned to ignore the castrato concealed behind the woman? Is it the man, Balzac, endowed by his personal experience with a philosophy of woman? Is it the author, Balzac, professing certain literary ideas of femininity? Is it universal wisdom or romantic psychology? It will always be impossible to know, for the good reason that all writing is itself this special voice consisting of several indiscernible voices, and that literature is precisely the invention of this voice to which we cannot assign a specific origin," close quote. A lot going on there and a lot of schoolyard giggling.
Yeah, boy, Balzac must have been taunted and bullied as a kid.
Yeah. When he was named that way, what was the intent of the naming? That's an act of naming. And how was it then interpreted by the audiences in the schoolyard? Barthes goes on to sharply criticize the modern focus on the author as a great individual, this sort of literary fixation on digging out the great author and finding their voice. And he is talking in the literary field like it's books. But it reminds me of the fixation on film directors as sole authors. Recently seen this with the Snyder Cut, for example.
That's the example of why auteur theory is a bad idea sometimes.
Yeah. Just because the author has a voice, it doesn't mean that voice is a particularly interesting one. But there are reasons for it. Some of them are perfectly good creators, and we're always using the surnames of directors, if we being, you know, critics and such, to understand everything. So we're using these surnames like Tarantino, Spielberg, Snyder, searching out the sole authorial voice in what is essentially a collaborative medium. So it's gotten to the point where we barely talk about screenwriters as authors. So criticisms of Prometheus relative to Alien focus rightly in part on director Ridley Scott jumping the shark, but kind of ignore that Alien was written by genre stalwart Dan O'Bannon, whereas Prometheus was written by the hack Damon Lindelof. So we've got someone who's really contributed a lot to the genre and someone who's contributed a series of damn squibs, and these are the writers, and yet there's all this talk of, well, Ridley Scott has gone downhill as a director kind of thing. So lots of people contributed to making Alien a great movie, but many of us, you know, us nerds, probably contributed to Ridley Scott getting high on his own supply as well.
Yes, I would say that Ridley Scott was going downhill as far back as Black Hawk Down, that purist propaganda and racist movie, and to Gladiator on forward. And we only lucked out that he didn't direct the sequel to Blade Runner. That's the only reason why it came out as good as it did, as much as there are, you know, criticisms for it.
And Hannibal was ridiculous as well. But I mean, also the point being, Alien was not just Ridley Scott. It was Sigourney Weaver, it was H.R. Giger, it was, as I say, Dan O'Bannon, it was Yaphet Kotto, it was endless unnamed crew members where you'd have to look at the credits. Their names are almost lost to history. Alien was made great because in a collaborative medium. So this idea of the author, the director as sole author, is really problematic. And it has been used also to justify really abusive behavior. I mean, you have someone like Kubrick, for example, or Francis Ford Coppola.
Joss Whedon.
Yeah. And I think Kubrick and The Shining is a very good example, and there's this idea that, well, this person is a genius, so they should have sole control. And in a collaborative medium, that means things like having control over their actors. And they've wielded it.
Traumatizing them.
Yeah, they've wielded it as abusive power of their actors. So the idea of a sole author in a huge collaborative medium, I think, is problematic.
Yeah, that goes all the way back to Hitchcock, his abuse of Tippi Hedren.
Yes. There's a disturbing history of movies I like where a good director decided the best way to create this movie was to essentially emotionally abuse the lead actress. You know, Lars von Trier is another one, for example. And it's like, I don't think it's necessary.
Oh, don't learn how the sausage is made, you know? You're going to find that every movie you like and every actor and director you like has something wrong with them.
But there is a choice.
They're child molesters.
Yeah, I still wouldn't completely exempt them of all responsibility. Scream is an interesting one where, like, Craven, from what I understand, is known for having good relationships with his actresses. And the scene is very supportive. But then on the set of Scream, Weinberg was also going after Rose McGowan, or off the set of Scream, actually. But, like, you know, in the background. So Craven was kind of okay, but then you had Weinstein doing his thing in the background. So it's Hollywood. Hollywood is horrible. But anyway, the point here is more just that, like, there is an issue with deifying directors, I guess is the point. That's part of the point, rather than a different way is making with authors and literature, is that they shouldn't be deified.
But don't you think authors of literature deserve it more, given that there is more of a collective art movie making, like you just said?
They are more authors. They're more straightforwardly authors. Like, it is easier to say, well, this person solely authored this thing, in a sense. Although, even then, you know, we talk about Bertolt Brecht, and Zeppelin Opera, one of his most famous works, was largely his partner at the time's translation of another text. We attribute it to Brecht, but it was essentially this gendered thing where he attributed his, I think he might have made changes, but we attribute to him something that was actually largely based on his partner's translation of another text. But even then, the deification of the author can still be a problem. But film is that much more collaborative. Back to Barth, he argues that certain kinds of subversive artists, like surrealists, undermine the kind of literalism that comes with author fixation, where we see an author as directly saying something. So it's hard to see in a surrealist work that the author is saying something.
So, like David Lynch.
Well, I was thinking, is David Lynch an example of this? Because I think in a funny way, he's a mix of both. Because the way he constructs films, it's all about the subconscious, and it's not didactic, and it's not message-based. But the way we talk about him is very much a way that Barth probably wouldn't like, which is that we're fixated on his voice kind of thing. But yes, I think he works in that way, in that he does not seek out to send a message. He seeks to create this space of subconscious multiplicity kind of thing. Barth kind of gets carried away with the surrealist multiplicity and the radicalism of it. He says that, quote, to refuse to arrest meaning is finally to refuse God and his hypostases, reason, science, and the law, close quote. Other French theorists, they get really enthused about their theses. So I'd say it's fair to say that the decentering of audiences and cultural theory didn't actually result in the overthrow of all existing social conditions. But his argument for centering audience interpretation certainly has some merit. So the essay concludes, quote, a text consists of multiple writings issuing from several cultures and entering into a dialogue with each other, into parody, into contestation. But there is one place where this multiplicity is collected, united, and this place is not the author, as we have hitherto said it was, but the reader. The birth of the reader must be ransomed by the death of the author, close quote. So Barth's position here is obviously fairly stark, and I'd argue we don't have to choose so starkly between the author and the reader like that. So my slogan, the author is undead, isn't so much rejecting his thesis entirely as kind of moderating it. So the author may be dead, but they're still hanging around anyway, shambling along, eating flesh, and it's kind of hard not to pay attention to them to some degree.
Kind of Schrodinger's author.
When the author is actually literally dead, as I'll talk about later, that's definitely Schrodinger's author. When they're around, it's Schrodinger in a different way.
Rowling.
Yeah, but now we know the cat is dead with Rowling, but yes, certainly there's the Schrodinger element.
Do you think she can't redeem herself at any point?
I sort of don't care. But so a point someone made to me actually yesterday, a friend of mine made, was that there's this generational divide around TERFery where, like, I know there's a problem sometimes with framing things generationally, but a lot of younger feminists are pro-trans, and there's this generational divide with a lot of older feminists kind of thing, and older leftists generally. And anyway, the point being that when Rowling turned explicitly TERF, this was a point where you could have seen a large layer where millennials turned TERF, but it didn't really happen. A lot of her fans turned against her. And I think this is a really important point, both in terms of the ethical question, which we've kind of bracketed a little bit, and the interpretive question, which is that actually audiences are not constrained by Rowling's limitation. They can have found something in these books as like teenagers and not be constrained by Rowling's politics. They're able to turn against her.
And we have to look at it culturally, socially, politically, in that, you know, England has lately become TERF Island.
But even if critics and theorists decided to ignore all authors in favor of audiences, there will still be audience members who interpret texts in light of knowing about the author. So there's a lot of reportage about writers, directors, stars. So audience interpretation is always already contaminated by knowing about the creatives. So taking the comic Watchmen and its movie adaptation as examples, if you know Alan Moore was an anarcho-communist genius and Zack Snyder is a far-right libertarian hack, that makes the exact same lines from Rorschach land very differently. So either way, if you're attuned to far-right dog whistles, you'll see that Rorschach is an ultra-reactionary. But in one case, that's supposed to be pathetic and terrible and something that we're questioning, whereas another is supposed to be really cool and edgy and exciting. But again, in that case, the characters are saying the exact same lines, so the difference is at least partly about knowing the politics of the creators, if you're a fan of that kind of fan anyway. Although there are also differences, I think. Like, Moore does more overtly signal the far-right affiliations, like that the magazine is a far-right magazine, there's graffiti referencing it.
That was the magazine of the John Birch Society. And the whole point was like it probably was never going to ever be publicized and was just going to be absorbed into right-wing conspiracy theories like fluoride and shit, you know? The whole ending of Watchmen completely misses that. And you think it makes your point and makes the point that the authors you're talking about here, the fact that Snyder can translate the exact words and dialogue and images of a document, of a text, and completely miss the meaning of any of it.
Yes, he as an audience member was decoding it certainly not the way that Moore intended. There's also people who watch Watchmen and think it is a radical critique of fascism, probably because they're picking up on the stuff that's in the Moore text rather than what Snyder's bringing to the table. Point being, the author doesn't determine what the audience member takes from it. Moore was not able to determine how various people in Hollywood decided to interpret his work. I think there's one adaptation he's satisfied with. I'm not sure what that is, but he's unhappy with basically all of them, of course. On the flip side, so I've said we're contaminated by knowing always about the authors, but sometimes we don't have the guidance of authors. So sometimes the author is literally dead, sometimes for centuries or millennia, and can't provide any new guidance on intent. And even if the author's heart is still pumping physically, their intent is often unknown or even concealed. So one example of this is Nightmare on Elm Street 2, where the writer intentionally included gay subtext, then lied about it in a wider context of homophobia, threw the gay actor under the bus, and then decades later admitted the subtext was intentional. So for an account of that, watch the excellent documentary Screen Queen, My Nightmare on Elm Street. But point is, for decades, there was this film that had been written to have gay subtext and the people saw gay subtext in, but the creators were denying that it had deliberate gay subtext. And so at that point, you'd see it as, well, it was a resistant meaning, it's just a matter of audience interpretation. But actually, it was just that we didn't know because they were cowards and weren't willing to admit to the subtext. When I say cowards, like, I think the fact that, like, it's straight creators screwing over a gay artist is also part of it.
Yeah, the writer is definitely cowardly. The whole thing came to a head in the documentary on the entire franchise of the Nightmare films, which is a really good one. I think it was American Nightmare or something like that. It's very thorough. They talk to just about everybody involved in each of the movies. And when they get up to part two, the writer is very cagey on that. And the star confronted him, and even the actor who played the coach called it bullshit on it. And he's in the documentary as well.
Yeah, well, the coach, like, they literally straight up near this beginning of this movie say he hangs out near those queer S&M bars. it's not subtext, like it's text. But yeah, it's definitely cowardice on the part of the author. Even once the truth is out though, as it is now with Nightmare 2, most audiences, you know, not people like myself and my glorious co-host Derek, a lot of people, normal people, don't spend days of their life digging up quotes from screenwriters and directors to discern the hidden meaning of movies they enjoy.
I mean, come on, Charlie Kaufman, some of us have work in the morning, damn.
The point is, audience interpretation is necessarily independent. We have to figure out the meaning for ourselves. So broadly, Barth was right, even if he perhaps overstated the case in his polemical flair. And a few years after Barth's death of the author, in 1973, British Marxist Stuart Hall wrote the essay Encoding Decoding. And outside the academy, Hall's terminology is probably less famous than the death of the author. Death of the author is an easier concept to kind of translate than encoding decoding. But encoding decoding is very influential in media studies, which is really my field. And looking at mass media, Hall offers a more industrial model than Barth, and he crucially separates the moment of producer encoding from the moment of audience decoding. But unlike in Barth's death of the author, for Hall, these moments are both crucial. Hall doesn't replace the author with the reader, but rather locates them as separate points in a circuit. So encoding and decoding are linked but distinctive moments. Hall links this to the analysis of commodity production in Marx, which identifies distinct moments in a process of circulation, such as consumption, production, consumption. But discursive production or cultural production is also distinct from other kinds of capitalist production because it concerns the production of meaning. So we're not producing something to eat or something to sleep on. We're producing ideas and concepts that people will be discussing and circulating. And this may be less tangible than other commodities, but it does have a concrete impact. So for example, if a movie reinforces sexist attitudes, that may reinforce sexist practices in real life. And for Hall, texts tend to have a dominant meaning. Specifically, he viewed mainstream media as encoding texts to reproduce a dominant ideology, capitalist ideology. And our second ever episode was actually devoted to that question, more looking at Chomsky's version of the thesis, and that was called Death Star PR is All Mainstream Media Propaganda, where Derek argued for Chomsky's thesis and I raised some issues with it. You can listen to that if you want, or maybe you already have, but for now we're going to park that debate and we'll just accept Chomsky and Hall's premise that corporate media largely encodes text in line with dominant ideology. The point for Hall is that producer encoding is a separate moment from audience decoding, and he identified three main kinds of decoding. First, the dominant hegemonic kind of decoding, second, negotiated decoding, and finally, oppositional decoding. So say if somebody watches Bayformers, the dominant hegemonic reading might be that US imperialism is awesome and women are objects. The negotiated reading might be that the text is problematic, but Transformers are fucking cool. And the oppositional reading might say that these are irredeemably reactionary and aesthetically ugly works which should be boycotted or ignored. So clearly, audiences respond in different ways, decode texts in different ways. And Hall's model challenged purely passive views of audiences and informed cultural studies from the 70s onwards. One problem with audience studies is we're often speculating, but Hall's work was actually tested by a famous study from his school, the Birmingham School. This is called the Nationwide Project. So David Morley and Charlotte Brunston, colleagues of Hall at the University of Birmingham, conducted audience research with viewers from different educational and occupational backgrounds, researching whether their social position affected their interpretation using Hall's framework of dominant, oppositional, and negotiated readings. And they were looking at a nationwide current affairs program, basically, and how well-known, you know, nationwide current affairs program was interpreted basically by audiences. And Morley found that of audience members, management tended to produce dominant readings. Those in education tended to produce negotiated readings, which I find very interesting because I definitely tend to be more in the negotiated rather than either, I would say, dominant or oppositional school. I am not always as oppositional as a lot of people. I'm more interested in a negotiated reading. And trade unionists tended to produce either oppositional or negotiated readings of this newsroom show. So while there were other complicating factors, including gender and race, which affected interpretation, the study did demonstrate that social position affects how audiences read text. And there are counter arguments to this cultural studies perspective, which became very popular in the academy from about the 70s and 80s onwards. So I'm going to wrap up by responding to a couple, specifically the essay on Fight Club by YouTuber Maggie May Fish. And I'm also going to respond to a speech China Mieville gave at an SWP conference a few years back. I actually haven't been able to dig up the Mieville speech, so I won't be able to put up a link. But then I wouldn't want to link to an SWP thing anyway. I'll link to the Maggie May Fish video. These are both broadly left perspectives on media and culture, but not ones I particularly agree with. So firstly, YouTuber Maggie May Fish's video essay on Fight Club. By the way, this discussion has implied spoilers and probably won't make much sense if you haven't seen Fight Club. And I'm also going to start by saying Maggie May Fish is well worth watching. Her recent work on Zack Snyder has been particularly excellent, but I do have disagreements with the media theory she presents in the Fight Club video, particularly the concept of the monoform she draws on. So Fish does present a plausible critical reading of Fight Club, particularly how it encourages audiences to sympathize with Tyler Durden, reinforcing toxic masculinity or even far-right terrorist sympathies. Admittedly, she highlights that this is the message it sends to an assumed audience, alienated white guys. So the assumed audience is kind of an important point here. Yet her theoretical argument asserts that there's only one possible reading, which is the one she's presenting. So Fish uses the concept of the monoform drawn from theorist Peter Watkins to reinforce her argument. In the monoform, audiences are so manipulated that they have no choice in how to interpret a text.
We are given the illusion of choice, but we lack choice when confronted with the monoform.
She quotes Watkins explaining this concept.
The whole purpose of 20th century mass audiovisual media is that it is not predicated on incorporating the ideas, feelings, experiences, subjectivity, memory, knowledge, wisdom of the audience.
And this argument could do with some Stuart Hall, in my view. Encoding and decoding are separate moments, and audiences decode in many ways. Audience members are capable of criticizing the protagonist in a film like Fight Club, but this depends on our own assumptions, experiences, politics, and so on. As a young queer teenager and a huge fan of Fight Club, I personally came to see it as a critique of Tyler's perspective, a satire of insecure, alienated masculinity lashing out. I made fun of boys at my high school who tried to form a Fight Club. I thought they were missing the point of the movie. To prove my point, at one point I showed Fight Club to a friend who agreed with me about our weird male friends but hadn't seen the movie, and afterwards she shared my confusion about why anybody would think this movie was advocating people follow Tyler, given the last act where his whole thing is shown to be completely absurd and a delusion based on insecurity. The point here isn't that we were right and they were wrong, it's that our preconceptions as audience members affected what we took from the movie. On many rewatches, I also increasingly admired and identified with Marla Singer, partly because Helena Bonham Carter is always iconic, but also because on rewatch you realize that initially confusing scenes were just her responding understandably, if sharply, to the narrator's literally psychotic behavior.
This is my house. What are you doing in my house?
Fuck you.
You know what, I really think it's time you got out of here.
Don't worry, I'm leaving.
Yeah, not that we don't love your little visit.
You know, but you are such a nutcase. I can't even begin to keep up. You fuck me, then snub me. You love me, you hate me. You show me a sensitive side, then you turn into a total asshole. Is that a pretty accurate description of our relationship, Tyler?
In her video essay, Fish argues that Marla is so consistently presented as ridiculous that even on rewatch, audience members will still see her this way as a ridiculous figure. And this may be true of certain audience members, you know, misogynists, but that may also say more about them than it does about the movie. Although Marla can be a comedic, sometimes melodramatic character, even this comedy has a campiness that certain audiences might identify with. So Fight Club author Chuck Palahniuk is gay, and if you read his novels, that camp sensibility is a recurrent theme, taken to an extreme in the very messy Invisible Monsters. But more to the point, despite her own serious mental health issues, Marla ultimately has a much better grasp of reality than the narrator. We'll leave the depiction of psychosis in the media for another time, but the point is, Marla Singer was right.
Listen, I tried, Tyler. I really tried.
I know you did.
There are things about you I like. You're smart, you're funny, you're spectacular in bed. But you're intolerable. You have very serious emotional problems. Deep-seated problems for which you should seek professional help.
I know, and I'm sorry.
Yeah, you're sorry. I'm sorry. Everyone's sorry. But I can't do this anymore. I can't. And I won't. I'm gone.
Gotta get off.
Thanks. Bye.
I've sampled that dialogue because it's all there in the text. After all the fighting between her and the narrator, after she exposes the narrator to himself, she calmly explains where she's coming from, how she's experienced this whole situation, and she withdraws. It might be a stronger statement if they didn't get back together at the end, but then this occurs after she confronts him with his own behavior, and he kills the alpha in his head. Viewers predisposed to see women as harridans, nags, difficult or crazy may not get any of this, and as Fish says, there are also cues in the text to read Marla as a ridiculous or crazy figure. But it's also true that we can only really see Marla through the narrator's perspective given the intentionally limited tunnel vision of the film. The point is simply that your understanding of all this will depend on what you bring to bear as an audience member. You can take Fight Club as a satire of alienated white masculinity, as an anti-capitalist screed, Renegade Cut, for example, as a video which presents that argument fairly clearly. You can read it as a reactionary work endorsing far-right terrorism, a celebration of raw homoerotic masculinity, a portrayal of a very sad man having a serious mental breakdown, a Life of Brian style satire of cult dynamics, or all of the above. Similar divergences played out with The Joker, a thematically similar, though much less sophisticated, much more boring film. Yeah, I still love Fight Club.
Yeah, Fight Club was very good, and I've heard the argument as well that Marla was in his head too. Is another personality.
Yeah. I mean, that's one of many. I'm a meaning person. I don't tend to get into what was the plot, especially in something that's so symbolic and so based on psychology. I don't tend to get into what actually happened. You know, people do that with Lynch a lot, where they're like, what actually happened in the David Lynch movie? And I'm kind of like, well, nothing actually happened. It's all made up. It's just a series of associational images that we can do something with. But yeah, I think the argument that was made with Marla, there was an argument that essentially that the narrator was trans, wasn't there? I've come across that.
I don't know that these are just different aspects of this, of one person's personality. I'd like to see how the sequel is handled.
There's a sequel coming.
The author wrote a sequel to Fight Club as a comic book over at Dark Horse Comics.
Right.
And
I didn't know about this.
Oh, I'd like to see how it, you know, because it's kind of weird to have a sequel to a story that's ambiguous, you know, where certain things happen in someone's mind, you know, kind of like having a sequel to American Psycho or something.
Yeah, by the way, the book and the movie have different endings as well. So the ending of the book, as I recall, and it's a long time since I read it, was essentially he's in a doctor's office, he's been institutionalized, but he sees the doctor's office as heaven and the doctor is God. That is definitely, to me, leans into the reading that this is just a portrayal of an alienated person having a mental breakdown, essentially, and there's all this stuff to do with masculinity and capitalism that's entering into it, but it's essentially a portrayal of someone's breakdown. Anyway, I'm not saying that's the correct interpretation. I'm just saying it's a complex text and audiences will take different things to bear and what they take from it, clearly. And the mere fact that Maggie Mayfish herself engages in a critical reading of Fight Club I'd say, undermines her monoform argument that the producer determines how the text is received. So in Stuart Hall's terms, Fish is engaging in an oppositional reading of the text. But the monoform theory says that oppositional reading is impossible. Only the dominant hegemonic reading is possible, as audiences are rendered incapable of critical thought by mass media. Arguably, this is an example of what can be called the third person effect, where we say the audiences in general are duped, but that we ourselves have greater insight. You know, I tutor classes where everyone believes that everyone else is duped and they themselves have this great insight. You know, this is not to deny that anyone may have a special insight on a text.
Dunning-Kruger effect?
Well, it can be a Dunning-Kruger. In Maggie Mae Fisher's case, she's a very good media critic and a very insightful one, and I would recommend looking up her channel. But the idea that we have insight and that audiences in general do not, there is a problem with that, and it's implicit in the monoform theory, and it's implicit in a lot of these audience effects theories that say essentially audience response is determined by the text. So I'd say the monoform theory, which is Watkins' theory, that mass media produces hegemonic audience effects, I think doesn't hold up. And another take I disagree with comes from China Mieville in a talk he given at an SWP UK conference. Boo, by the way. Mieville argued that there's no shame in enjoying pop culture, but that pop culture has no real meaning. And this was a long time before we heard a lot of these things about Whedon. But he compared finding feminist meaning in Buffy to saying that a can of Coke has an anti-capitalist message. The argument here is that cultural products bought and sold on the market don't have any deeper meaning, and that any meaning found in a cultural product is commodity fetishism. Which makes me wonder if his books, which are published for a profit, have any meaning. Aren't his books commodities? Is finding anti-capitalism in a Mieville book commodity fetishism, since they're bought and sold on the market? Is this equivalent?
Well, he's just being very pomo with his books then. Huh?
No, he's very anti-pomo. He's a hypocrite, is what he is. Is finding anti-capitalist meaning in a Mieville equivalent to finding anti-capitalism in a can of Coke? Or, and this is, I think, the implicit belief, are books somehow fundamentally different from visual media? Do books have meaning and TV shows don't? Is visual media inherently more deceptive, and is reading inherent a more intelligent process? I think there's an inherent elitism in this argument. He also doesn't confront that point at all. Like, he's part of that crew of people who mass publish anti-capitalist books, but then talk about how mass publishing anti-capitalism is impossible. You know, there'll never be mass publishing of anti-capitalism. At one point, Mieville grants one exception. He sort of grants a limited exception, which he says is okay, whereas all these other ones aren't, which is the Palestinian activists who dressed up as Na'vi from the movie Avatar for a protest. And this, in his view, is valid, but was an exception to the rule where pop culture in general means nothing. But there's a problem here, which is what I've been arguing, which is that audiences are inherently plural. They bring many experiences to bear. So treating resistant reading or resistant encoding and decoding, because I guess the activists are also encoding in their own way by dressing up and filming it, but treating these resistant audience acts as isolated exceptions fails to actually theorize that exception. He just sort of mentions it as an outlier, which perhaps shows Mieville is about 40 years behind the curve of contemporary cultural theory, but I guess he's very well read. He's probably aware of the cultural turn in audience studies and just being contrarian. But if that's the case, his argument is superficial at best. I'd say Stuart Hall got it right in the 70s. Producer encoding and audience decoding are separate moments, and decoding can go in many directions. So that's why we can acknowledge at once that Avatar has problematic aspects as a text, but that its reappropriation by Palestinian activists is a separate creative moment of political activity. We can acknowledge that Morrissey is a massive racist without discrediting his significant Latino fanbase, who find meaning in his work despite his personal politics.
Oh, my abuelita had a jukebox in a restaurant. Yeah, only played Morrissey. And if anybody ever complained, she'd be like, oh, no te gusta más? You know, Chicanos, we call them Mas. Then adios. What can I say? You know, we relate to his melancholy ballads, you know?
we can also acknowledge decades of queer-coded Disney villains who LGBT viewers have enjoyed as points of identification. In the opposite direction, we could point to Reagan's powerful misuse of Springsteen's Born in the USA, or the somewhat less powerful Trumpist appropriation of Rage Against the Machine Killing in the Name Of. There was a video circulating with like five boomers singing along to Killing in the Name Of at a Trump rally. But these are both songs explicitly critical of US imperialism and racism. I mean, personally, I thought that Born in the USA was an US imperialist song until an old communist friend of mine played me the acoustic version. And hearing the acoustic version, it was easier to pay attention to the lyrics. And I was like, all right, this is about how Vietnam was like a terrible thing. But because it had that sound, that stadium rock sound, and the chorus sounds jingoistic, Reagan could misuse it this way in a way that was kind of effective. And obviously they were wrong. Reagan was wrong. The Trumpists were wrong. What's new?
How could they get Rage Against the Machine wrong? It's anti-police and they believe in Blue Lives Matter and are against black people.
Yeah, who the hell knows? Like, you know, again, as we shouldn't speculate on the mind of the author, perhaps it doesn't do well to speculate on the inner minds of the Trumpist, because it is often incomprehensible. But obviously they were wrong and didn't understand the songs. But for politics, the formal meaning of a text matters less than how it's mobilized in the real world. So this isn't to say we should cede Springsteen to all Rage to the right, but that we have to actively reappropriate them. Because even the most radical creator, I am a fan of Zach De La Rocca or Tom Morello, can't guarantee their work will be used in radical ways.
It's ironic too that like nobody's exempt even within the bands, because like you have the drummer of System of a Down going alt-right and Trumpist. One of the Mumford & Sons guys had to take a break because he was going alt-right.
Yeah, if we were to decide that author intent was all that mattered, then in the case of collaborative mediums, I guess we would have to come to Mieville's conclusion that they have no meaning, but I think that has a problem, because clearly if Reagan is blasting a song at his rallies, then there's a reason for that. It does have an effect on the world. So media texts aren't completely free and open. There's no personal interpretation that would make Birth of a Nation not racist. But then recognizing or not recognizing the racism of that text may be determined by your experiences or your politics. Viewers bring so many experiences, tastes, and ideas to bear that any text is bound to have multiple interpretations. This is just an empirical reality of how audiences respond to texts, and any theory that doesn't embrace empirical reality isn't a very good theory. It comes down to the fact that audiences are capable of independent thought, though we may not always apply that capacity. We're not brainwashed, and the author may be undead, but we are alive.
This beautiful television has put me, like I said before, in all sorts of situations. I remember being very scared to it because an Icelandic poet told me that not like in cinemas where the thing that throws the picture from it just sends lights on the screen. But this is different. This is millions and millions of little screens who sent light on you, some sort of electrical light, I'm not really sure, but because there's so many of them, and in fact you're watching very, very many frames when you're watching TV, your head is very busy all the time to calculate and put it all together into one picture, and then because you're so busy doing that, you don't watch very carefully what the program that you're watching is really about. So you become hypnotized. So all that's on TV, it just goes directly into your brain and you stop judging if it's right or not. So you just swallow and swallow. This is what an Icelandic poet told me once. And I became so scared to television that I always got headaches when I watched it. But then later on, when I got my Danish book on television, I stopped being afraid because I read the truth. And that's the scientific truth, which is much better. You shouldn't let poets lie to you.
We are all interested in the future, for that is where you and I are going to spend the rest of our lives. And remember, my friend, future events such as these will affect you in the future.
On today's show, we're going to reveal the horrible truth. But first, I'd like to tell you about Squarespace.
Spoiler warning for Godzilla vs. Kong. Welcome, fellow travelers, to the Where's My Jetpack podcast review of Godzilla vs. Kong with guest Jace Short. Jace is a doctoral student at the New School for Social Research, studying ancient philosophy, but also a huge kaiju fan who's spoken at several conventions on the topic, published some writings in Red Wedge magazine, and published an article in the collection Giant Monsters in Our World by McFarlane, titled Monsters of the Rift, Kaiju as Ciphers of Unbalance, which is very worth reading in terms of the sort of ecological underlying themes of the genre. And this is the second time we've had Jace on. Regular listeners may remember the two of us reviewed a whole bunch of kaiju flicks for the Christmas episode. So welcome back to the show, Jace.
Thank you. Glad to be back.
Your hosts, Derek and Ani, will also be giving our thoughts, but we're going to let Jace kick off the review. So what were your thoughts on the movie?
Okay, so right off the bat, I think it's important to point out that like a good portion of this film is basically a heavy metal fever dream. You've got Kong racing through the hollow earth, and there's this like epic synth music playing, and he gets a giant axe, and you know, Godzilla blasts a hole through the center of the earth. I mean, this is so over the top. And the director, Adam Wingard, mentioned his love for King Kong Escapes, which is like literally like a cartoon come to life. It was a Rankin-Bass cartoon, and Toho turned it into this really zany film that's a favorite from a lot of fans. And so with this one, between the almost excessive editing of character moments, there were 30 minutes of character work eliminated before the final cut, the reuse of footage for scenes it wasn't intended for, all of that kind of stuff really makes this feel like a classic Toho film with its flaws. And famous comic book Godzilla artist Matt Frank, he described this whole film as a cartoon come to life. And I think that captures the essence of what makes this movie work. So I was a huge fan of Godzilla King of the Monsters, but general audiences just didn't connect with it. Some argued that it was because of how much it leaned into the classic Toho tropes, but as we can see, Godzilla vs. Kong sort of raised this to an art form. I think King of the Monsters attempts to be about something and to deploy a classic family drama just didn't work for audiences. It just wasn't compelling or well done. And I found it interesting, but I can see how it wasn't enough for others. And really, Sarazawa's self-sacrifice was this really emotional moment for like a subset of fans like me. But for others, it even alienated them. And then for general audiences, it didn't really make sense. That was a moment that was sort of like rhyming with the original Godzilla film. So I think that Godzilla vs. Kong really feels different. Audiences, you know, with the response, audiences are really raving about it. Critics like it. Audiences like it. Many are having their first post-pandemic theatrical experience with this film. It was that for me. Not that it's exactly super safe to do so in the United States at the moment, but I've had my shots and there was hardly anybody in the theater at the time. It feels like this film is like the right level of escapism for this moment.
In a year where everyone realized we're at the mercy of nature, the world will sublimate that anxiety into watching a giant monkey fight a giant lizard in a perfectly timed release before we snap and punch and or kiss the mailman. I'm scared to see this in a theater. Not because of the virus. I've just completely forgotten how to interact with people.
Everyone's a bit war-wary with politics and social commentary with the pandemic and the crisis of the Trump administration really brought with the election and like the question of, is there going to be a peaceful handover or not? I think a lot of people really enjoyed having this kind of spectacle to just take their minds off of things. And it's strange for me to celebrate that because generally I'm of the position that fantasy and science fiction, horror, these things should really have a biting political impact and critique. But, you know, kind of for once, I don't know, I get why this resonated And I appreciate that the MonsterVerse films, they've nonetheless kept this underlying theme of ecological balance in the background. So it's not totally missing from this film, but really, I think what they were trying to say in King of the Monsters bothered some people. Like a lot of the most like insightful voices in the fandom took issue with the positive spin on radiation that happened at the end of Godzilla King of the Monsters, claiming it was a betrayal of what Godzilla had stood for. And I'm not in agreement with that critique, but it's a reasonable way to read the film. And, you know, if a major section of fans don't like a movie and audiences don't like a movie, the film's not going to work. And I'm really glad, as a kaiju fan, for this one to work. I do think there's some, you know, major issues. We could have used some more character work, and the villains were a really missed opportunity. I mean, this was Dr. Sarazawa's son who was piloting Mechagodzilla, and we said nothing about his motivations, what drove him to do that. There's some like Lex Luthor versus Superman man style material at work here, with the CEO's desire to put humanity back, you know, on top of the hierarchy with Mechagodzilla, and it's just left unexplored. And I think Kong's journey was this like really beautiful thing for people to watch. The effects work with his face continues this tradition of like really good special effects work with ape emotional expression. You know, we saw that with the remake of the Planet of the Apes movies.
I was about to make that connection myself. The signing and communication aspect, and just the visual effects we now have to have sort of expressive ape characters. Yeah, I very much agree with that. And I thought I was thinking of it myself, thinking about the signing aspect of the film. But yeah, sorry, go on.
No, you're yeah. And I think Kong really allowed us to experience aspects of this film that we don't normally in a kaiju film. Normally there's always the question of like, what do the humans do? And they're watching, and we're sort of watching through them watching. But with Kong, it made, you know, it gave you this kaiju that's just humanoid enough that you were able to feel something of what he felt. I remember my best friend and I were watching the trailer for this, and when you see Kong looking off the aircraft carrier in the ocean and seeing Godzilla's spikes as he's like swimming around him like a shark, he noted, he was like, oh, he looks afraid.
Yeah, he's almost the lead of the protagonist of the movie more than any of the humans are, you could say.
Absolutely. Yeah, I think so. And I, you know, there's something too, like he travels to the underworld and gets a magical weapon to fight this like dragon figure. There's some hero's journey stuff going on with that. And it's interesting just the way it's treated. Like, you know, he's the underdog the whole time, and yet he is sort of defeated by Godzilla and then revived. And then he gets to get the glory kill on Mechagodzilla. But they were able to show Godzilla and his like godlike power and near invincibility that, you know, kind of characterizes him. And Kong's vulnerability and cleverness and kind of the scrappiness of his fighting style, they were able to balance those out really well. The kaiju fights are what made this film, and that's how it should be. That's what people are coming to see it for. So that aspect of it just made it really wonderful for me. And I'm a huge fan of Mechagodzilla 2, and bringing him in as a villain, I was worried that they weren't going to treat him right. You know, I'd seen how they treated Kong and Godzilla in their films, so I could trust the studio to do something with them that would make sense. But with Mechagodzilla, I wasn't so sure. And I really loved this instantiation. I mean, we got the best of both worlds, the sort of humans making it as a way to counter a kaiju, but also it has those callbacks to Kiryu, where he goes on his own. He separates from the pilot, and Mechagodzilla becomes sort of self-aware. And there's just this sort of, you know, monstrosity, Frankenstein's monster. So that was an excellent part. And I appreciated getting some MonsterVerse action with Godzilla being more villainous. I mean, he has a reason why he's doing the things in the film, and he's not just wrecking things for the, you know, sheer hell of it. But nonetheless, like, he shows up in the first 10 minutes of the movie, and he's the kind of frightful Godzilla that we saw in his less heroic endeavors. And the MonsterVerse films have, if anything, they've really leaned into this Godzilla as the hero, as the savior of humanity. It was nice to see him as a terror again. But yeah, I guess that kind of like sums up my thoughts. There's a lot to say, and I think you're going to say something about the character of Gia and like the sign language and stuff. There's so much wonderful material with that, but I'm just going to point it out. And it's something that I hope they develop more if they do more films. But yeah, that more or less concludes my review.
Do you have a score out of 10?
Yeah, I'm difficult with scores out of 10, but I'm going to give it an 8 out of 10. But like, I feel like I should give it 2 scores. Like, kaiju fan, it's a 10 out of 10. And general audience movie, like well-crafted film, more like a 6 out of 10. So maybe the 8 out of 10 kind of blends them together.
I'm 7.5 out of 10, so quite close to that. Yeah, I agree. If you're going to score just the knockout battles, those are like 9 or 10 out of 10. But as we're going to talk about, if you're going to score the rest of the story, maybe some more issues there, which I'll talk about. But first off, I agree that it is essentially a cartoon. I mean, it hit the same spot in my brain that watching, you know, the sort of Saturday, Sunday morning cartoons hit in your brain kind of as a kid. But also the other thing in my brain is that it automatically seeks out the deeper meaning, even in a cartoon, which is half of what this podcast is about, and I think you're the same.
Yeah,
you know, that's why we're nerds. But before we get into that, into the sort of does it have a deeper meaning, what have you, it was a solid blockbuster experience. It had great battles. I loved all the decapitations, as I think you mentioned. There was a kind of visceralness to the fights in this, which with CGI you don't always have the viscera of battles. Sometimes they can feel a bit weightless, but this had a real sense of visceral, yeah, violence in a fun way. And watching on the station IMAX, there was a lot of applause, especially for Kong. I'm still more of a Godzilla fan, but despite this movie perhaps leaning more towards Kong, still managed to toe the line and please both sides. And introducing Mechagodzilla as a common enemy allowed them to dodge coming down too hard on one side, making it just a King Kong movie. And in a way, Mechagodzilla felt pretty arbitrary, even if he does have a backstory and also a backstory in the entire Toho kind of universe. But it was kind of a deus ex in a way, and it could have probably been interchanged with really any common enemy, but it still worked. And probably because this is a knockout battle movie, like its pleasures have a lot more in common with pro wrestling than some other, you know, cinematic genres. And in pro wrestling, you can get away with just throwing in a heel to freshen things up.
And I kept thinking, like, did somebody at Monarch let Kong watch pro wrestling? Because, like, his moves were, like, reminding me of some of King Kong Bundy or some of the larger wrestlers in the WWF, like Andre the Giant or somebody. And I really loved the Kong parkour scenes on the ships and the buildings. I thought that was sweet.
And by the way, you know, we're also fans of King of the Monsters at this podcast, particularly the eco themes, which we discussed in our review of it, which if people want to go back, was December 2019. But just focusing on one aspect, I've been saying that your enjoyment of King of the Monsters, especially the battles, may depend on what screen you watch it on, because the darker cinematography could end up washed out if you watch it, say, on a laptop in the light of day. I thought King of the Monsters was beautiful on the big screen with the high contrast and backlighting, which made it not washed out and more murky. You could say this is still partly true of Godzilla vs. Kong. It's always the case with these blockbuster movies that they're likely to be more enjoyable on a big screen. But I think the brighter cinematography here might make it less of a problem. It is, I think, better designed to be watched on any screen. And at least it's less likely to end up washed out or difficult to follow than something that's sort of darker. And I took this note about the difference before rewatching it on a smaller screen and sort of tried verifying it last night by watching it on my laptop. And there was less of a glaring gap between the big screen and small screen experience, at least for me. Than there was with King of the Monsters. And obviously this being partly made for a streaming audience, I think that was sensible. And I know there were people who criticized the cinematography of King of the Monsters. So it seems like they made the right choice there in lighting the scenes a bit more brightly. This entry also developed the lore of that movie and the MonsterVerse generally with the Hollow Earth aspect. I kind of was less sold on that than both you and Derek, actually. There were good aspects. You know, the whole journey to the center of the Earth was initially intriguing. It had some nice aesthetic aspects to it. But in the end, I wasn't really sold, partly because of what the ultimate narrative purpose it served, apparently, which is to give Kong a home. And to me, Kong already has a home. Skull Island is already his home. And giving him a new home solves a problem that wasn't really a problem. You know, sure, there's the storm, but then that's just a randomly introduced bit of backstory that then isn't apparent in the cinematic version. And the problem prior to that was people invading, people not understanding the place, people abducting him in the pre-Monsterverse versions, or even in this one, abducting him again. And Kong Skull Island, which is a brilliant movie, was kind of the apocalypse now to original Kong's Heart of Darkness. And so with the journey through into the island, kind of subverted the racism that's honestly baked into the original Kong and many of its remakes. And arguably, Kong Skull Island was the first really to do this, to subvert the racism of that story. You know, compared to Peter Jackson, who just shamelessly lends into the racism. This verse has been a little better on that, but at the same time, I did think the Godzilla vs. Kong's resolution of that issue, it didn't quite satisfy me. Kong had already existed in balance with the tribe and the island, so the problem wasn't his lack of a home, it was, frankly, imperial intervention upsetting that balance. And admittedly, imperialism is a hard problem to solve in a knockout battle movie 2 hours long. But, you know, who's to say now that people know of the Hollow Earth, they won't do the same thing again? It doesn't seem to solve the problem to me. And, you know, even if they didn't overthrow imperialism, which is a big ask, even so, an ending like Jurassic Park 2, with the kind of conservationism and non-interference on the island, worked better for me rather than sort of relocating him. But there were some nice aspects. I enjoyed the sign language with Kong. That was cool, as we mentioned. And I actually just watched Gorillas in the Mist. So this brought out that some sort of maybe simplified aspects of that, where in that you have a few stages of communication with Sigourney figuring out how to mimic them. And this brought out sort of a somewhat simplified version of that into a blockbuster story. And that element of sort of interspecies communication was one of the more interesting aspects of this, and the fact that also her deafness actually gave her a communicative advantage was really interesting. So I enjoyed that part of it. Overall, though, it was stronger on spectacle than story, I'd say. So Legendary Monsterverse is almost like the inverse of the Marvel Cinematic Universe. So in the MCU, the CGI battles are just boring and feel weightless. But the characters always sparkle, so they'll often have a great first two acts with like these really enjoyable, entertaining characters. And then they'll just have the boring ass, dragged out third act CGI battle. And the Monsterverse is, again, it's kind of the inverse. It delivers on the kaiju front, but it's more patchy on the human front. That said, there were some nice character moments here. They're really just moments here and there rather than anything developed. The conspiracy skeptic Kiwi, played by Julian Dennison, was MVP for me. So as a conspiracy skeptic Kiwi myself, it was hard not to overrelate and project onto a minor comic relief character. And his breakout New Zealand role was Hunt for the Wilder People by Taika Waititi, which, by the way, is worth a watch, as anything by Taika Waititi is. And Dennison's performance and also his self-deprecating sense of humour here was profoundly Kiwi. And I guess there had to be improv, because the writers probably wouldn't capture that on their own. So a quick Google search did confirm there was a lot of improv in those scenes. You can kind of tell.
Okay, I'm smart, but I only go to high school.
It's a living supercomputer.
I'm not used to this. I'm used to pirating movies online.
Damn, I thought you said you were a hacker.
I just said I took an HTML course at summer camp.
HTML?
Yes, at summer camp.
Was it a 90s camp?
And also he coined Mechagodzilla. So that was a nice little moment.
That's RoboGodzilla.
No, that's Mechagodzilla.
And again, I was a bit skeptical of all the conspiracy theory stuff. It really feels like playing with fire in the current context. But then I've often said that conspiracy theories make for better fiction than political theory.
A friend of mine, Andy Campbell, who had a podcast some years ago, Kaiju 101, at the end of it, like the first thing he said to me was, well, Madison is definitely into QAnon now.
Yeah. Well, it felt so directly like that. You know, it was very overt with the fluoride brain stuff.
Do you realize that fluoridation is the most monstrously conceived and dangerous communist plot we have ever had to face?
That felt a bit more harmless like 10 years ago. There was a joke on the Honest Trailers where they said the best conspiracy theory jokes of 2007. Because, you know, that seemed funny then when it was all just, oh, triangles and isn't that all very silly. But now that we've had this resurgent far right, it sort of resonates a little differently. So I felt like they were playing with fire there again. And initially I was like, well, is this a dog whistle? But then I wonder if they just didn't really think it through rather than it really being a conscious dog whistle. I mean, I love They Live. I love the Society, the body horror film. I love lots of films that have a kind of conspiracy theory plot, because again, it does make for a good story. Conspiracies make for great villains and David and Goliath stories, but maybe being aware of context, a bit more like consciousness of that might have been good.
I think, just to interject really quickly, there's something to like 80s and 90s experience of being a kaiju fan when there wasn't really the internet and we didn't know how many movies there were and stuff and such. There was a overlap of being a kaiju fan, being into dinosaur movies, and this whole like Bigfoot cryptid world that I think this what this was somewhat, you know, trying to like connect to. But you're right. I think, you know, yeah, playing with fire is exactly right. I think it would have hit differently, too, if the conspiracy theorist had been, you know, a white guy who looked like Alex Jones.
Yeah.
You know, it at least helped to soften the blow a little bit to have a non-white guy doing that. But anyway, yeah.
I was thinking the same thing. People of color are perfectly capable of participating in the far right.
Right.
But at the same time, it did make it feel less like it might be playing to white supremacy, even so. One thing it did remind me of, and hopefully fans don't get upset hearing my vicious attack here, but the ridiculous response to King of the Monsters poor reviews, where people thought the reviewers were being paid off by Marvel or to tank the MonsterVerse. And I was just like, come on, critics probably just don't get the movie. That was the first thing my mind actually went to with the conspiracy theorist stuff. I mean, I think it was probably just that they were having kind of fun with it and maybe didn't consider that. I related hard to his awkward interview request where he goes straight from introducing himself and shaking hands to like asking for an interview. I've done that myself. That got a laugh from me. So I ended up relating mostly to the comic relief characters rather than any of the more serious characters. And you mentioned Serizawa's son not being developed at all. And that is a fair point, but there was like an interesting element there that was his relationship with the Apex CEO. And actually, the CEO's kind of ruthless get in the mech attitude very much reminded me of Evangelion.
Yes. There's the get in the robot moment. Like, just straight up Evangelion reference there, I think.
We have no idea how this energy source will affect the mecha.
Get in the goddamn chair.
Yeah, I think that was a direct reference. And it's that kind of theme of this utilitarian war, you know, the mech is a weapon and the young being forced by the old to, you know, to get in the robot. But these were just kind of brief hints at an idea. You know, Evangelion develops that idea into this apocalyptic, amazing thematic level, whereas this kind of had these brief hints of an idea and then just kind of moved on, which was often the case with a lot of things this movie touched on, I thought. Back to Hollow Earth, from a story perspective, they build up the journey to the center of the Earth and then they immediately leave for the climax. And you're right, the aesthetics were cool. I know Derek was more into it from a kind of lore perspective, so perhaps he can speak to that. But I feel it's such a tight blockbuster, it might have worked better as a backstory footnote than like a central element of the story. When actually the main action ultimately all happens on the surface, or the main Godzilla versus Kong knockout battle action, it all happens on the surface. So, I mean, honestly, bring back the 90-minute movie, keep it tight, kill your darlings. I do appreciate that the director said he could make a 5-hour cut, but he doesn't want to. And it's funny, you know, I say it shouldn't be extended, but at the same time, there are so many little tantalizing hints of something deeper that aren't developed. But perhaps rather than extending it, they could have focused on one aspect of the human story from the start, you know, not so much slashed things later on as just focused on something rather than spreading the story so thin. The Toho movies tend to follow just one team in Japan. You know, there's one problem-solving team. Rather than a lot of these MonsterVerse movies, this and King of the Monsters in particular, it kind of feels like you've got two, then three, then four sets of characters that they're kind of following. I feel like a straight action story should have an A plot and a B plot rather than sort of C, D, E, and F plots that are all kind of skimmed over. But ultimately, I mean, it was solid fun, you know, it worked just as a spectacle. So again, it's a 7.5 out of 10 for me. When you're getting that granular, maybe I should be scoring out of 20. But for me, best of the legendary MonsterVerse is still Kong Skull Island.
Yeah, I don't know that I'm able to make a judgment quite on what the best of the MonsterVerse is, but I tend to go towards Skull Island too. It just feels like it does everything right. There's enjoyable characters, the setting, it's beautiful, it moves along at a good pace, it makes sense. So yeah, I kind of tend to fall into that camp too, though King of the Monsters definitely has more emotional impact on me than anything else, but that has to do mostly with just having this like long, obsessive relationship with Godzilla.
My order of the movies: Kong Skull Island is the first, second King of Monsters, third Godzilla versus Kong, and fourth 2014 Godzilla.
I was gonna say about the Hollow Earth stuff, on the one hand you're right, but it's introduced in each of these films, barely mentioned in the first. Then it's a major point that's going to be coming up with Skull Island, because they discover like that's kind of an entrance to the Hollow Earth. And then it becomes a huge thing in King of the Monsters. We see the temple and, you know, Godzilla's home and all of that. Really, you know, the ancient ruins really, I think, gave you the sense of wonder that drew you into the movie in a different way than just seeing the giant monsters. You got that from Skull Island, just from Skull Island, from the nature of the island. And I think in King of the Monsters, you've got that sense of awe, you know, with the temple. And in here, you really just got blown away with dropping Kong into this world.
I think I'm maybe a bit rough on it. And like, it actually did work aesthetically. I think the size of it was one thing that worked aesthetically. It reminds you that actually the planet is huge. So if you're going to have something within the planet, it's not a claustrophobic space within the Earth. So it did work, you know, on some levels. I'm not totally sold on the idea that Skull Island isn't a good home for Kong. Like, to me, that's never been the issue, and it felt like this just turned it into an issue. And yeah, I mean, definitely the Hollow Earth had been built up over the series, but my first initial unfair note straight after watching the movie was that it felt like lore for the sake of lore, and that it didn't actually add to the central story all that much. But maybe I'm wrong. I feel like there were maybe some issues with it, but overall it sort of worked mostly because of that journey aspect, you know, as you say, the hero's journey, Kong also conquering the other kaiju during that journey, and then finding his kind of weapon and returning. I guess it worked on that kind of mythic level, even if I can have my like little pedantic issues. It looked good, I'll admit that much.
I was looking into the history again, because, you know, this is something that was considered seriously by scientists and is actually famous here in Florida, about the Hollow Earth theory. We have the village of Estero in southern Florida that was established and incorporated by followers of this guy, Cyrus Teed, who proposed this theory that people live on the inside of the Earth's outer skin, as we saw in the movie, and not in like a Dyson sphere, and that celestial bodies are all contained inside the Hollow Earth. So you had the spheres within spheres. This theory, he called it Koreshian unity, and they bought a lot of land around here in 1894, and they were even going pretty far. They incorporated the town in 1904, And what's always joked about is that Teed claimed to be immortal, but he died in 1908. And that was pretty much a critical blow to the group's faith. And their membership actually kept going, but was dwindling into the 1960s. And their foundation is still around. It's called the College of Life Foundation. But the tract of land that they originally owned is now owned by Florida as the Koreshan State Historic Site. And it's a local tourist site, especially if you're into weird Florida history or taking a haunted Florida tour or looking for the skunk ape or something like that. And I think we might have heard some quotes from members of that cult at the opening of the movie where we heard John Goodman describing the Hollow Earth. I'm not sure, or possibly other people talking about it. And part of the theory has the entrances, of course, in the North and South Poles, as we saw in the, you know, in the movie. But, you know, like the problematic conspiracy theories, the Hollow Earth has actually been sucked into esoteric fascism and Hitlerian occultism since the 1950s. The latter's founder claimed Hitler and the Nazis escaped in Nazi flying saucers to fly to Antarctica to survive in the Hollow Earth to this day. Ripping off old novels like Vril, The Coming Race, incorporating Hitler's influence, Madame Blavatsky of Theosophy, her myths about Shambhala that she got from Tibetans, or the Agartha myths in Tibet. And now it's, of course, mixed with everything from UFOs, secret governments, lizard people. So, you know, one has to really be careful when using the concept to not use the Nazi version. And it looked great in the movie. It looked closer to Jules Verne in Journey to the Center of the Earth. And I noticed an area that was obscured by a massive storm, not unlike the one around Skull Island. So, you know, that could have been leaving things out for, you know, for the future. And, you know, that could have been hiding some other biome full of more kaiju, or even a lost civilization, you know, for future movies. And I kind of felt like my whole thing with the wasting of kind of Hollow Earth, I kind of felt like the end got into Man of Steel territory, with Hong Kong being completely leveled and likely thousands or millions of people dead.
And all three of them team up against the city of Hong Kong. No wonder this movie is huge in China.
And I think a cooler third act could have had the humans and Kong, you know, drawing Godzilla and Mechagodzilla into the open terrain of the Hollow Earth for a final showdown and team up.
That's exactly what I've been thinking, is like, if you've got to focus on the Hollow Earth stuff so much, then bring it together with the Godzilla versus Kong, which is, you know, the main plot. Like, have the final battle in the Hollow Earth if you're going to focus on that so much. And as you say, it does also avoid the collateral damage issue, or reduces it.
But yeah, that's what I was thinking. Another thing was that they were really short on the humans this time. They've completely taken it to heart to just really be minimal with the humans. And I didn't appreciate Lance Reddick's role as the head of Monarch getting cut down to a few lines after cutting the rest of his scenes. But like, at least it's in his contract to be in the head credits, you know, no matter how little his role was. But with the Hollow Earth, you know, I was like thinking, well, where was Joe Morton and the rest of Monarch? You know, I like the carryover of other human characters from King of the Monsters, but like, where was Joe Morton as the older version of the scientist from Kong Skull Island, who wrote up the Hollow Earth theory with John Goodman? Because it was like he and John Goodman here are totally vindicated by the existence of the Hollow Earth. And I also felt like the Iwi were glossed over, and they didn't really explain the tribe being wiped out. Because they could have really talked about that with the little girl was the last of her people. Kong was the last of his kind. Godzilla was the last of his kind. You know, you had some overlapping themes there that totally weren't even touched. But I really enjoyed this one, but it just felt too short and shallow compared to the others. All three of us liked King of the Monsters a little bit more. I also have been pointing out how TV shows and movies likely because of the nuclear industry lobbying and maybe the military working on movies, have created a positive spin on radiation or ignore its downsides altogether. And it's really downplayed in comic book movies, of all things, where it's like the source of powers and mutations, whether Hulk or Spider-Man getting bit by a radioactive spider seems to be ignored or downplayed now, or the X-Men, that being one source of mutations. And overall, I think it's actually no accident, because, you know, the dangers of nuclear power and fallout have not changed since Three Mile Island. And actually, we're at more risk of nuclear war or terrorism now than during the Cold War. So I find the whole phenomenon suspect, especially with nuclear fallout healing the Earth in the last movie, where stuff was growing back because of radiation.
Yeah, especially when that one has probably the most explicit ecological themes, the sort of almost Gaia theory of the reason all the monsters or all the titans are returning is to restore the balance. But then the way they restore the balance is through depopulation and radiation.
Yeah, and the eco-terrorists were the bad guys, the environmentalists were the bad guys, and nuclear power the good thing. It kind of retconned what happened in the first movie with the nuclear radiation in Japan. Because a lot of the times I've seen a lot of the downplaying of nuclear radiation has been about downplaying the nuclear radiation fallout in Japan. And a lot of the land has been irradiated and a lot of people are showing up with radiation in their system in Japan. And people try to act like, you know, nuclear power is totally safe. I wanted to say my main take, my overall take, was that Godzilla vs. Kong is about humans commodifying nature as if we can control it, and then the chaos that causes and ensues. And here we have Mechagodzilla built by a human titan of industry, pun intended, who used his massive fortune and tech, thinking he could force humans up the ladder above the titans to dominate them in nature, and then, of course, loses control of Mechagodzilla. And in each of these movies, you can see that humans can only hope to like get out of the way and not get stepped on by these avatars of forces of nature, which is very Japanese animism. Basically, you know, you get out of their way and hope that the winner is the one that can maintain the balance of nature, as we've seen with Godzilla so far. And man's hubris with the CEO threw nature into imbalance, and the mutual aid, I would say, of Godzilla and Kong was required to take Mechagodzilla down, this technological monstrosity who bled oil when he was cut. I really love that. Wingard said he redesigned Mechagodzilla because he wanted to improve on the Transformers movie look. He said, "I remember watching the third Transformers movie in the theater. It was one of those things where I was with a date and we got there, and the only seats that were available were literally in the front row. And so I'm sitting there watching Transformers 3 in the front row, and I couldn't tell what the hell was going on. The Transformers, they just look like metal. They look like a plane crash. So I thought, that's the thing I wanted to avoid. They were too complex. There were too many moving parts, and I couldn't latch on to anything. Nothing felt iconic with that Transformers design." And I think that's actually a brilliant takeaway he got, and that really informed the design of Mechagodzilla, because it had a really lived-in,
but also streamlined in terms of shape.
Streamlined. And I would say, aside from lighting, which has gotten better with each movie, especially this one, I would say in each of the movies, you could tell what the hell's going on, unlike the Transformers movies. And that's a major improvement over Michael Bay. Why is it so hard for those scenes to be coherent action and editing? And I noticed this movie had four editors, and I think the last one did too. Some stray thoughts. Neil Cavuto on Fox News was complaining about this movie that a tech CEO was the villain of the movie instead of the monsters.
It was just such a long... How many movies have evil mega corporations? They're an a good villain to have that anyone can connect with, because everyone hates mega corporations. Certainly not limited to this universe.
Yeah, I think Apex is in the running for trying to catch up to Weyland-Yutani here. And I really like the design of the Heaves, the Hollow Earth vehicles.
Yeah.
I understand those were a reference to old vehicles from another.
Okay, yeah. Like, they're like, well, there's a lot of Toho mechs of that type. You know, they had looked like things that you would see in, like, the Heisei Godzilla films, the Super X 1, 2, and 3. And then there's other kind of vehicles. Hovercraft vehicles and King Kong Escapes. But yeah, it just had this feel of it, like a late 60s, early 70s Toho movie that would blend kaiju with flying saucers and everything else. Like, it was nice to throw that element in there too.
I don't know if you caught that when Kong threw the tree at the screen, that was Sector 7G, like on The Simpsons.
Oh, no, I did not catch that.
Yeah, I didn't catch that till the second time. Another thing I saw was when Kong was on top of that building and he threw the construction crane, I was thinking, was that a Donkey Kong reference? And I also thought, something that kept bothering me when I watched it the first time was Godzilla didn't look right in this movie. And I thought some angles did not benefit Godzilla's design with his face. I noticed Godzilla looked better slightly from a profile or from the side of his face.
Yeah, I will say real quick, Toho had apparently made a requirement that they not have Godzilla emote with his...
Yes.
And they tried to work around that, apparently, and like the way he's almost too expressive at points in this, because, and the expression's all the same. It's just rage. And when he's enraged, it's like he's clenching his fists and pushing his chest forward and screaming. And it doesn't seem like, I mean, it's like more of a human movement, I guess, than like, it's not what you would expect from Godzilla. So yeah, there's some moments where he looks a little wonky. I still think he looked best in King of the Monsters.
Yeah, and the last ideas for the potential MonsterVerse continuation, given the popularity and box office success and HBO Max success, which dethroned the Snyder Cut, thank God. I think one blog was saying maybe do some more prequels, like the way Kong was a prequel, or even go all the way back to like the Titans fighting millions of years ago. There you go. No humans altogether, you know. And the director definitely wants to do more in Hollow Earth. And the scene at the end at Hollow Earth was actually the post-credit scene, but they moved it to the end because they weren't sure if this was going to go on. And I've been saying for quite some time that they need to bring in Gamera, bring in more Titans from mythology or Lovecraft or something. They had the plan still to do a Pacific Rim crossover. I think that would be very easy. Hell, have the portal in the Hollow Earth or something. I don't think it would be very hard for the ideas and aesthetics of the MonsterVerse and Pacific Rim universe to merge at all.
Yeah, I can see that working. Get Guillermo del Toro to direct a Tohoverse or, you know, a MonsterVerse movie. That'd be great.
Yeah.
So what's your score out of 10?
7 or 8 out of 10. So I wasn't the only one thinking about Donkey Kong there.
I did not think of Donkey Kong, did not think of The Simpsons. I did think of pro wrestling.
Oh, there's also at the ending, they credited Lethal Weapon 2 because of him popping his shoulder back in. And to quote the Blue Oyster Cult song, Godzilla, which had a really good rendition in the last movie, history shows again and again how nature points out the folly of men.
Thanks for listening, everyone. If you like what we do, please go along to our Patreon at patreon.com/jetpack1917, or you could give us a positive review on Apple Podcasts. That'd also help us. And Derek?
And we'll see you in the future.
You have seen this incident based on sworn testimony. Can you prove that it didn't happen? We once laughed at the horseless carriage, the aeroplane, the telephone, the electric light, vitamins, radio, and even television. And now some of us laugh in outer space. God help us in the future.